Okay, let's do this, folks. I know I want to be able to, I don't know, like have like a potato chip before my panel. Okay. Welcome to this week's episode of The Read Out Loud, a weekly biotech podcast from STAT. I'm Allison DeAngelis.
I'm Adam Feuerstein.
And I'm Damien Garde.
It's Thursday, March 21st, and here's what we're going to talk about this week.
So this is another one of those weird off-the-cuff podcasts where we're actually recording live from STAT Breakthrough Summit East, our big event being held in Midtown, New York City, where the likes of Feng Zhang, George Yancopoulos, Jennifer McNairy, and Allison DeAngelis. Are gathered to talk about the future of medicine. And we're going to talk about a little bit about what we heard in this morning's session. You also may notice murmuring. Is that a word?
A little bit of ambient chatter.
Chatter, noise in the background, because we are recording this podcast from one of two lunchroom dining areas as part of this. There are people in front of us who are eating what looks to be a very, very nice catered lunch. None of us have had this lunch yet, and we're starving. But maybe we'll be able to eat the lunch when we're done.
And such is our commitment. I did want to note that the tablecloths are white. And so to the plates, just the phrase lunchroom, I think, may conjure images in the mind of the listener of a greasy spoon. And in addition to all of the highlights from this lovely non-greasy spoon event that we are all at, we will also discuss the latest news in the life sciences, which includes a twist in the GLP-1 story, the cost of gene therapy, and of course, pie.
All that after a word from our sponsor. That's my line, Adam.
I'm sorry.
Hey, Read Out Loud listeners, Bob Herman here, STAT's Business of Healthcare reporter and the writer behind the newsletter, Healthcare Inc. Healthcare Inc. is a weekly newsletter devoted to unpacking the business and secret inner workings of the U.S. healthcare industry. If you're someone who has ever received a medical bill or craves in-depth policy explainers or loves a playful meme now and again, I highly recommend you check this newsletter out. Learn more at the link in this episode's description. And now, back to our regularly scheduled programming. Thanks.
So when you last heard from us last week, we were recording the podcast, and then we were going right into the STAT Pie contest. And there's some good news to report from that contest. Allison, give us the winners who were like basically the podcast. We won this STAT Pie contest.
Unsurprisingly, yeah. The podcast swept the pie contest, pretty much.
It was a clean sweep almost. Yeah.
Adam, our esteemed colleague, was given the popular vote in the contest for his key lime pie.
It was a very, very good key lime pie.
I must humbly say that I received third place in the judges' vote for my cranberry lime pie with a ginger snap crust. And our podcast producer, Teresa, took first place.
Amazing.
For her potato galette. Round of applause, please.
I mean, remember, we said last week that going the savory route in the pie contest was a very strategic, smart move. And sure enough, Teresa won the whole darn thing. Way to go, Teresa. We're very proud of you.
Speaking of calorically dense foods and their effects or lack thereof, this is a tough transition. GLP-1 medicines, famous topic on this podcast and probably every other podcast in the world, mostly Wegovy from Novo Nordisk and Zepbound from Eli Lilly, approved for obesity. But a major question about their future on the market and their future as forces in our society was how the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Administration, the government health insurers, would treat them. And we got some news on that front really just hours ago. What happened?
Absolutely. So CMS has indicated that they will be covering obesity products as long as they have kind of additional medical benefit, which we've started to see. You know, we've seen promising data in, cardiac disease and, heart disease. We've had chatter with, the effects on MASH and liver fibrosis. And in those cases, CMS now says they are willing to pay for those medications. Now, that's both good and bad, right, Damien?
Yeah, well, it depends on whose perspective you look at it from. I mean, there was a Congressional Budget Office score suggesting that paying for these medicines would cost the federal government more than they would save from those effects you mentioned demonstrated in clinical trials of preventing things like heart attacks and strokes. I think there's some debate over how those numbers might shake out. But what we also learned is that it's quite likely that because these medicines will be covered, they would very soon join the list of drugs that are party to or subject to pricing negotiation by Medicare and Medicaid, and so, or by Medicare particularly. So it'll be curious how this nets out. It makes sense that based on the benefits demonstrated, these would be drugs Medicare should cover. It also makes sense based on the way that the Inflation Reduction Act is written, that they would almost immediately become the kind of medicines that that bill was meant to allow negotiation for. It's possible that when we zoom out, and I wonder, you know, if Lilly, Novo, and others were sort of given truth serums and put on this podcast, that this just kind of moves us to a place that everybody thought we'd probably get to, which is that the net prices are going to come down and the adoption of the medicines is going to go up. And in the end, they're going to make so much money that really, no matter what they say in the next days, weeks, months, even years about what that negotiation does to them, this remains a massive business proposition for these companies. And really, it is net good news for them. It just has to be, just because more people will get them.
And the impetus for this, the immediate impetus for this, was that large cardiovascular study, outcome study that was done, the SELECT study, which showed a cardiovascular outcomes benefit for people who are on these drugs. And so that, as you mentioned, Allison, that heart benefit coupled with, you know, obesity is the impetus for this coverage, expanded coverage by Medicare.
What a new era we are entering. Talking about, you know, new innovations, I have to say I really want to talk about Feng Zhang's panel here at Breakthrough Summit East, in which we learned, or I like to think that there is a, you know, a multiverse version of Feng Zhang that never became a, you know, CRISPR pioneer.
Yeah, we learned that when he was in middle school, he hated biology. He thought biology was boring, which I thought was a kind of a funny comment from a guy who now is sort of famous for fundamentally changing biology in a lot of respects with
CRISPR. Well, it was boring before he got involved.
But then he said that he saw, he said that one part of his inspiration was watching Jurassic Park.
Which he called a documentary.
And maybe his famous academic brethren, George Church, is trying to, you know, bring back extinct species, dinosaurs and woolly mammoths and the like. You know, maybe for him it is a documentary. But that was part of his inspiration. But sort of learning that, you know, coming to this realization that through biology, through molecular biology, you know, you could fundamentally cure diseases, find the root causes of diseases and treat them. And obviously he's, you know, I can't keep track of how many companies.
I think it was seven was the tally.
I think he can't even keep track of all the companies that he's started.
No. And to hear that he had a whole life before he started working on CRISPR in his early to mid 30s, you know, where Feng Zhang was best friends with the guy who started Pinterest, was working at Google. If we're going full string theory here, there's an entirely different universe where, the world of genetic medicines looked very different. And I, for one, would really like to, you know, engage in that kind of philosophizing of what that world would look like. But we'll keep that to another podcast.
I thought it was
episode.
Also interesting. You know, our colleague Megan Multeni interviewed Feng Zhang, and she asked him about the sort of this recent trend of these privately financed sort of medical institutes, medical research institutes that are sort of now, you know, basically throwing huge chunks of money at scientists who are in academia to sort of come out and in the context of him being very much a Broad man, a man of the Broad.
The Broad Institute. Yeah.
And, you know, he sort of kept to that, I felt like, when he talked, you know, he wasn't going to, you know, it didn't seem like he was going anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Even though, I mean, one of his, you know, kind of contemporaries has embarked in that new venture. It was a really fascinating comment. Let's roll the clip.
You know, it used to be that a single person in the lab can do a series of experiments and make an important discovery. But nowadays, biology is becoming so multifaceted. There are so many different approaches that will require a lot of people with different expertise to really bring it all together. There are also a lot of data that will require yet a different set of expertise to be able to process and make sense of that information. So all of that, I think, really requires research to become much more team-based, more interdisciplinary. And also, some of these problems are getting harder and harder, so it will take a much longer time horizon to be able to solve those problems. Traditional academic structures may not be the best for tackling some of these issues. We've seen great advances in the computational biology area. The development of AlphaFold 2 by DeepMind was an amazing accomplishment. And that was done by a team of really top-notch computational scientists. Within an academic setting, you wouldn't have the resources, both financial resources and human capital resources, to be able to tackle a problem and be able to execute and successfully deliver a result within the time span that DeepMind was able to accomplish. So I think all those things really suggest that while there are still things where the traditional academic model is really appropriate for, there are many other things in biology we need to explore new models.
The always entertaining George Yancopoulos, Chief Scientific Officer of Regeneron, also graced our stage today, interviewed by our very own Matt Harper. Damien, what George is known to say sometimes outrageous things. Did he say anything outrageous today?
I would leave that diagnosis to the the ear of the beholder. But it was interesting because, yes, of course, like George Yancopoulos, one of the has been at Regeneron for in excess of 30 years, and in that process have they developed 12 approved medicines, many of which work very well, many of which lead their given categories, and his accolades and plaudits sort of speak for themselves within biotech circles. And among those, maybe accolade, plaudit, not the right word, characteristics that speak for themselves in biotech circles is his speech. He is prone to get on stage and say exactly what he thinks. It's quite often bold, occasionally confrontational, sometimes iconoclastic. I mean, there's all sorts of adjectives you could reach for. In this instance, I thought what was fascinating is, you know, one of the third rails, arguably, when people from biotech companies speak out loud is the word cure. One should be careful with it, I think, is the conventional wisdom. And George, I'm not saying he was not being careful, but he said Regeneron's next big idea, if you will, is to cure allergies. And he spelled out the means by which they'll do that. And, you know, I won't get into the details, but it begins with Dupixent, which is their very potent treatment for allergic-related diseases like eczema and asthma and likely soon COPD. But then it also, kind of cleverly, incorporates one of their cancer medicines, a bispecific antibody that is designed to treat multiple myeloma. It turns out it targets the same cells that produce the errant antibodies in the body that lead to allergic diseases. And so George believes that you can give one dose of this cancer medicine to people who don't have cancer but rather have allergies, and then give them a maintenance dose of Dupixent, conceivably for the rest of their lives, and in that process you will have cured them of their allergies. And it works in monkeys like a charm, I believe he said. Sounds like that would be a difficult path forward drug development wise, but to that George responded, "I think the first patient we treat in our clinical trial will be cured." So, you know,
I mean, it's a big statement. It also feels like where the industry at large is moving. I mean, just this week, you know, I wrote about a new immune and immunology company, sorry, inflammatory, I should say, company that just launched with $400 million because investors, drug developers are looking at this decade of cancer drug development that we've seen. And, you know, things that have happened with, in this case, you know, the Prometheus Biosciences drug development for an inflammatory bowel disease, and have said, wait a minute, we can do more with this science. We can push this further. We can, you know, squeeze more juice out of this. And investors are willing to go for it. It seems like pharma on many, you know, instances is behind this pathway. And we already know that these can produce blockbuster medications. So I see George's point. The cure label obviously is something that we will continue to discuss for years to come. But I'm understanding his investment theory.
So George showed up today with his guns out.
Yeah.
Now, by guns, I mean his well chiseled biceps, wearing a t-shirt. It's kind of cold today, but George, as he likes to do, showed up looking physically fit. And I this is an awkward segue into a question for Damien. But you know, he had some things to say about the obesity drugs and particularly Regeneron's approach to developing a drug for obesity. What did he talk about?
Right. Well, it begins with, I think George looks at the explosion of demand for GLP-1 medicines and the increasing number of people taking them as itself a public health problem in the making. People would say obesity itself is a public health problem in the making. He's arguing that these medicines are on the verge of creating one that perhaps people did not foresee, and that is because the people who lose weight on them lose both fat and muscle. And then when you stop taking them, you generally gain most, if not all, of that weight back, but you're likely doing it disproportionately in fat rather than muscle. And so to George's mind, that's a vicious cycle setting up by which people will yo-yo on their body weight, but each time they move down and then back up, their percentage of muscle mass just goes down. And if you look at that health-wise, a lot of people who are, you know, elderly or elderly and obese, I should say, a lack of muscle mass puts one in real physical danger. Well, as most things George says, Regeneron has the solution to the problem. And so getting to your point about getting swole, separate from George's own workout regimen, which I imagine is formidable, Regeneron has a medicine, they've had it for some time, that has demonstrated to increase muscle mass in healthy volunteers in studies. I think they had initially developed it for a muscle wasting disease, but now they're looking, I think quite reasonably, at the GLP-1 situation and saying if we pair this medicine, which is proved to boost muscle mass, with a GLP-1 medicine that is proved to cut body weight, could we have a cocktail of therapies that preserved muscle mass while shedding fat and thus, you know, was kind of the miracle medicine that people are searching for? Now, again, as with the cure for allergies, it works in monkeys, George noted, but they will soon begin a clinical trial. And it's one of those things that our colleague Elaine Chen has written about, that effort and some others that are similarly paced, and us and you as well.
Indeed.
It makes sense on paper. Like, it's an understandable next goal for companies looking at metabolic disease and looking at really the net effects of widespread use of GLP-1s and seeing a similar problem that George suggests.
I'm curious to see how, I mean, based on this plan that he's laying out, how it affects the GLP-1 drugs. Because in another like related comment that he made, he was kind of decrying the fact that, you know, society is now turning to these drugs that make you lose weight in part because you're so nauseous and like taking away, you know, I mean, I think, you know, societally, I'm sure that there's a New Yorker piece about how our relationship with food is changing because we're making ourselves nauseous and therefore losing weight. But I mean, it was very much of the opinion that that was bad. Now, with this plan in drug development that he's having, will that also be something that Regeneron ends up addressing? I don't know. It would be very interesting to see.
We could probably shift the conversation out of Tracy Morgan and how he managed to gain 30 pounds while taking Ozempic. But
which really feels like it was a 30 Rock episode from 2009.
So as I said, we were recording this podcast during the lunch hour of our event. In the afternoon, Allison, you are moderating a panel. It's in the future. We haven't heard it yet. But why don't you tell us a little bit about the panel that in kind of what you're expecting or what we should be expecting to hear from the folks you got on stage?
Yes, in you know, just a few minutes, I'm going to be getting up on stage with patient advocates, experts in the drug development area to talk about the interactions between advocacy groups, patient groups, and the FDA. And I mean, one of the particular points I want to ask them about is how they feel the Amylyx situation is being handled, which we discussed at length last week. We also have people on the panel who can talk about sickle cell disease, who can talk about, you know, Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and the precedents that have been set over recent years, and the effects and how we should be handling this for, you know, in the time moving forward, given that the FDA, from many accounts, and I mean, from your conversation with Peter Marks at our JP Morgan event, is very open to approving or using accelerated approval, I should say, to introduce more gene therapies for patients that, you know, have no treatment options right now, or very few treatment options. So we are now going to switch to a clip of me talking in the future.
In the future.
In the future. I hope you enjoy this snippet from our event. You can also catch us at events in May in San Francisco and in October in Boston. So we hope the next time we record one of these live, we'll see you here.
And the next time we record a podcast from one of our events, we're going to eat lunch first before we record.
Maybe.
I hope. That would be smart of us to do that.
Please welcome to the stage independent ALS advocate Kathy Ollett, associate professor at the Yale School of Public Health, Dr. Greg Gonsalves, parent advocate and owner of Canary Advisors, Jennifer McNary, president and co-founder of Six Cells, Ashley Valentine, and to moderate, Stat Biotech Startups and Venture Capital reporter, Allison DeAngelis.
Yeah, Greg, you had something to say on that point.
So drugs that we put in our bodies should be shown to be safe and effective, not reasonably promising of effectiveness. And effectiveness is not a matter of the Yelp for drugs. It worked for me, it didn't work for you, it worked for you, but it didn't work for you. The point is we do clinical trials to keep from fooling ourselves, right? We have a drug like Aduhelm that all the advisors, half the advisors, more than half the advisors on that FDA panel said, we can't live with this, right? And FDA said, let's go ahead. CMS said, you know what? We're gonna have to put the brakes on this because we don't believe the data is there. But Biogen and the Alzheimer's Association were out there saying, this is a breakthrough for patients with Alzheimer's. My dad died of dementia, right? My uncle had it. You can guess what I'm thinking about my future when I hit 70 and hit 80. So I don't want more drugs, I want drugs that work. And that phrase came from a friend of mine, Fran Bisco, with the National Breast Cancer Coalition. She's been fighting this fight for a long time. And we really have to stop being willing to put hope out there as a talisman in exchange for data, right? We need to know if the drugs work. And yes, while your son may have had some benefit, we need to know that it applies across the board. And then we're talking about this person's son and that person's son, and it maybe worked for me, or I knew I was on the drug, but I was on the placebo. Let's not forgo the chance for generations after us to know what a drug does in their body because we want access tomorrow. We can balance that, right? We can have expanded access programs like the Parallel Track, which we put together at the same time accelerated approval was put together, because we wanted the data, we wanted the answers, and we wanted the access. But to start saying reasonably predict benefit is not what's in the regulation, and it's not what's good for patients.
Greg, why do you think that, you know, expanded access is something that hasn't been used more? I think we talked to you beforehand about the fact that it's often used in oncology, to your point. The disease areas that we're talking about, not as much. Why do you think that is?
So I'm a little cynical. I think what we've had is a little bit of extortionism by industry, frankly. Telling patients, you're not gonna get the drug, we're too small, the patient population too small, we can't afford an expanded access program. You know what? Maybe we should have some conversation to the FDA about accelerated approval or breakthrough therapy, right? AIDS drugs went out to 30,000, 35,000 people before approval through expanded access. And yes, it's not, you know, ALS is not at AIDS, but we have ACT for ALS. We have $75 million for expanded access programs, right, for ALS. If we can do that for ALS, we should be able to do that privately funded for other diseases. Companies need to step up. It needs to be built into the drug development process. Talk to your backers, talk to your venture capital, and say, this is part of the deal, right? The return on investment means return on investment for patients now while we get the data for tomorrow.
Kathy, what did you want to say?
To Greg's point, we had 5 years ago, we had zero expanded access except for a couple of one-offs in ALS land. And I went to the CoupaCon 5 years ago, and it was like all these people in oncology were talking about expanded access, and I'm like, we'll have what they're having. What is this? This is. And we started going to sponsors, some of us, and saying we need expanded access, and they consistently, the message back was, we can't afford it. And my message back was, no, you failed to plan for it. You can't, if you build it into the plan, the cost of it in this dreadfully expensive drug development scheme, it's not that bad, but you gotta plan for it. You can't just walk down the hall and say, we're doing expanded access tomorrow. And I think we've had an impact there, pressing companies to plan for it, that's an expectation if you're doing clinical trials in phase three, that there be a companion expanded access program. And we are having some success in that area in ALS.
We've got a question from the audience, I believe.
So Matt Herper said it's okay to be provocative at these events.
Yeah, if Matt says it, it's true.
So Professor Gonsalves, I'm a professor at UC Berkeley, and I'm going to push back very hard on what you just said. Nobody wants to do experiments on human beings. Nobody wants to give people false hope. We have all read the Belmont report. You have my word. What you said is unequivocally wrong as it applies to N of one or N of rare. I don't know if you attended Julie Vitarello's panel this morning. Mila Sen will have never been approved by the FDA. But had she been dosed early, her life would have been saved. There are 2,500 children newborn with inborn urea cycles and metabolic diseases for which we will build CRISPR N of one medicines. They will never be approved. So this idea that somehow everything is Aduhelm or everything is, you know, PARP inhibitors for breast cancer simply flies directly in the face of the way genetic technologies, genetic medicine technologies have evolved over the past 5 to 6 years, where we absolutely can and will do trials on an N of one, and this will never be an approved medicine, but we have to have a path of those quote unquote never approved medicines to the market and to patients to save their lives.
So I'll push back. The point is that we're on a new era of gene therapy, and the promise is there, right? But as Ashley has said, we don't know what's gonna happen. We're in a wait and see mode for even the gene therapies for sickle cell, which have shown great promise. So if we're gonna undermine the regulatory system, not on behalf of biomedical researchers or parents or advocates, but on behalf of a really political push to weaken the regulatory state, whether it's EPA or it's FDA or any of the other agencies that we depend on to keep our lives safe and protect us, what comes next, right? So don't throw out the baby with the bathwater, right? Yes, we can support novel regulatory approaches for rare diseases, but that's not what's happening now. If you look at the Promising Pathways Act, if you looked at the Food and Drug Administration Modernization Act in the 90s, it's all about the slow drip, 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 drip in terms of lowering the evidentiary bar at the FDA. And that's what's happening, right? We can find flexibilities, but we shouldn't throw out the baby with the bathwater and say we need to return to pre-Cafavor era when we just put drugs out on the market because they were just safe and they might be effective. Because there are opportunity costs for patients and families for drugs that don't work, right?
Jen, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I'm actually gonna agree with you about lowering the bar. So I don't think we need to lower the bar at the FDA. The great thing is this good work you did with accelerated approval, I will push back because reasonably likely to predict benefit is actually in the accelerated approval pathway. So that is the thing that we're looking for, right? Something that's safe and reasonably likely to predict benefit. And I would just say expanded access or a commercialized product where the company can then take in cash flow to then produce more innovation is, again, exactly the path that we have to look for, because one is not going to be enough for everybody. You have people who are going to do an RNA-based therapy, a small molecule, or a gene therapy, and you have to have companies that are able to reinvest the money that they're getting from one product into another product or into another disease state. And so, you know, again, I never went to school for any of this. I don't have a degree in anything at all, but what I have been able to see is a system that needs that reinvestment or you aren't going to get further products. And one, the first in human is never going to be the best in human, right? You're going to have to see things build. Innovation begets innovation. And if you don't give companies, small companies with these itty bitty patient populations, an opportunity to recoup that money, then you don't see that reinvestment and we lose the incentives that we've built over the years. And you get back to that diagnosis that equals a death sentence. So I think expanded access is important. I tell all of my clients, build it in if you can, but at some point you have to make a return on the investment. I think this is a room full of investors that would agree you have to have a return on that.
I do wanna make a note. It seems, I don't know, maybe antithetical to me. I mean, I cover investors. It seems like incentives should come from my perspective, from, you know, the scientists, from the venture capitalists. Is it appropriate for like incentive to come from FDA by approving a product that then makes a company money, even, you know, if it then ends up getting taken off of the market or, you know, it's priced quite high when it has an accelerated approval and we're still waiting for full evidence?
I think if I can chime in here, I want to bring us back to some of just like the rare disease populations or sickle cell populations. And you had mentioned, you know, wait and see. And I think many of our populations are okay with that. And so sickle cell was discovered in 1910. We didn't get our first approval until 1998. We didn't get actual disease modifying specific clinical trials for sickle cell until 20, it's 2015, and the very first sickle cell specific drug was Endari, and that was 2017. That was major for us. So sure, it's not perfect. Sure, it doesn't work for everyone. But the fact that FDA delivered and brought us a treatment that sort of works is great. We waited for that because now the providers had something else they could prescribe and try. Everything in medicine is try. Without the drugs that are specific for the disease, they're just trying something else out. Everything is a science experiment until you have those disease modifiers that are actually meant for your condition. So, I mean, from our community perspective, we absolutely take those drugs that are good enough because we understand from the patient population that these need to be tested. And what's scarier than testing a new treatment is testing no treatment at all and having people succumb to the disease. So, I mean, that's what I would say to this whole conversation. And yeah, absolutely, FDA should approve these drugs on accelerated approval. But then I think that's where the post-market study comes in. That's where some of these guardrails are there so that, you know, we can be honest. Let's gather the real world data. Is it actually working? Is it making the patient sicker? Now that we've tested them in the real world, what are those levers that work and don't work? And then let's reevaluate in 3 to 5 years.
I know we have an audience question really quickly. You mentioned an asterisk beforehand with relation to accelerated approval. You just mentioned guardrails. I mean, the asterisk that you mentioned is not something that we really have in place when it comes to pricing. Do we need to introduce that?
I think we need to have serious discussions about pricing, period. Mm. And when something does not have, to me, when a product gets a traditional approval, mm-hmm. in ALS, we don't have the biomarker to use accelerated approval easily. So when a product gets traditional approval, if it's been done based on thinner evidence than the old gold standard, I think we have to have some very serious discussions about pricing. And that's hard to do when people are dying, and here's something that might help, that there's some indication that it might help. Those are very difficult discussions. And I also believe, quite frankly, our large disease organizations run away from pricing discussions like the plague. They don't want to have those. And I think we really do need to have them. There are, to me, if you don't have a full approval with the two studies, I don't think you should be getting premium pricing for your therapies. And we're talking about, with Relyvrio, $158,000 a year. And the only reason that was priced that way because a prior approval of Edaravone, which was an old Japanese stroke drug, cash cow, that was repurposed for ALS with modest results, was priced at $160,000 a year. So Relyvrio came in under. So, I mean, those are just, to me, those prices are just absurd for things that are not really changing the trajectory of the disease that much.
That does it for another episode of the Read Out Loud.
Thank you to Teresa Gaffney for producing this week's episode and to Jesse McQuarters for live engineering.
Our senior producers are Hyacinth Empanado and Alyssa Ambrose. Our executive producer is Rick Burke, and our theme music is by Brian Joel.
We'd love to hear from you. Tell us what you like about this week's episode, what you didn't like, and take a guess about how much George benches. You can do all that by sending us an email at readoutloud@statnews.com.
And if you like what we do, leave a review or a rating on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you use to get your podcasts.
See you next week.